So we'll just try to bring our attention into the body. Just so it's helpful to close the eyes and sit in a comfortable way that you can be alert. You want to be both alert and relaxed. So this kind of sweet spot that meditation tries to find. And there's a kind of progressive development in a or any period of meditation. So it's not uncommon to start out feeling restless or kind of not very settled. And so we can take some active steps to settle and to relax. We can talk about that, but it's also important that we be willing to sit with those feelings, to not run from them, to not, you know, give up. You know, the practice of mindfulness is one of turning toward whatever is present. So another kind of balance is the balance between accepting what we're feeling and working to let go any obstructions to our meditation. So it's best to start with the accepting part, being present, recognizing clearly how you're feeling. And then if there is tension or restlessness, just breathing with that, having a sense of softening. You can use your exhalation, maybe a deep breath and a slow exhalation. To begin a sense of calming in the body and a calming in the mind. Then we begin to just scan the body. Feel through the different areas of sensation. In some ways, it's quite striking to see that even though we think of ourselves as just having one body, when we scan the different sensations, we see that there are many different ones happening at once. So it's more like many bodies. Can also be felt as a kind of field of energy or a field of energies. that our nervous system isn't really an electrical system in some sense, and that's not solid. There are solid elements to that system, but they, what they transmit is not solid, the electrical energy. With the eyes closed, it's interesting to just feel the body in this way as a collection of electrical energies pulsing, firing, moving. When we talk about the body seeming to dissolve in meditation, this might be what that's referring to. Shifting from the earth element of weight and density to this fire element of electrical energy. Oh, in the midst of that field, see if you can locate the breath. This gives us something a little more specific to focus on. The air element. Feeling the touch of air at the nostrils, or the movement of the belly. So the breath and the body are what we call meditation objects. They're things we can pay attention to, sensations, experiences we can use to focus on. The tendency of our minds, though, is to drift into thought. So we also need to integrate awareness of the thinking into our practice. Just noticing when the mind wanders and gently coming back. our relationship to thoughts has a big impact on our meditation, whether we're frustrated at it or whether we are at some ease. If we're trying to suppress thoughts or we see them as a problem, something that shouldn't happen, or a failing, then our practice just becomes frustrating. So we need to have an accepting attitude towards thoughts. Even a curiosity about what we're thinking, what captures our attention, what we obsess over. At the same time, we don't want to make that kind of investigation into another mental excursion. Our mental processing is so rapid, though, that we can just glance at a thought and get a great deal of information and then go right back to the breath. So we don't have to hang out examining or reflecting on a thought. We just kind of take a glance, that, and then come back to the breath. Those brief moments will accumulate information and data that will take shape for us quite effortlessly, even unconsciously. We'll come to understand certain things about our own minds, about our own thought habits. And you can think of each returning to the breath as a beginning again. It's not so much that you're picking up where you left off, but just that you start again. We'll often find that getting lost in thoughts also triggers tensions in the body or restlessness. So in that regard, we need to start again in the body to settle the body. Just a breath, just a calming breath, reconnecting with the sensations. So I have to admit that I really know nothing about anatomy or anything. And so what I'm saying about the nervous system, I don't know if that's really accurate, but I think to me, what I'm really doing is describing a felt experience. So whether it's exactly scientifically accurate or not, I'm not sure. So I apologize if that's, you know, and particularly if you're knowledgeable about that and you're like, that's not the way it is. I'm sorry. That could be distracting. So I want to mention, I got an email from Insight Timer last night. They said that I'm like one of their, today I'm like one of their, you know, they do this thing, the daily whatever. What's it say? It says, for Tuesday, our team has chosen present moment breath to be featured on the app's guided featured list. So anyway, if you're interested, there's, I have a bunch of, at least several guided meditations on Insight Timer on the app. So that's available. So yeah, I was going through kind of preparing my notes for step 9 the other day, and I realized this is not an easy part of this book for me to talk about, because it gets awfully personal in here. But this section is not so much that. Well, I can skip over the personal part. So in case you're new to this class, I'm going through my book, One Breath at a Time, Buddhism and the 12 Steps. And we are in step 8 and a section called The End of Isolation. And so this kind of starts out by talking about how, you know, meditators in particularly like in the West, we sort of view, we give primacy to meditation and silence and being alone. I'll read this first paragraph. I've talked about how meditators may be a self-selecting bunch of isolators. A practice that requires so little human interaction can be quite appealing for people who struggle with personal relations. The Buddha recommended solitude for meditation practice, and many people take that to mean that living alone and limiting human contact is the most spiritual behavior. This conveniently overlooks the fact that the Buddha set up his monastic communities to be completely dependent on their lay followers and as communal living settings. Since the monks weren't allowed to store, grow, or purchase food, they had to interact with other people every day, or they would quite literally die. Theravada monks continue this tradition to the present day. This isn't to say that meditating in solitude isn't helpful. Of course it is. And that kind of quiet is especially conducive to the development of concentration and the deeper meditative experiences. However, these activities are not the whole of the holy life. These experiences only give us the basis for a holy life, the tools. We still need to use these tools, mindfulness, compassion, and wisdom, in our lives with others. While deeply developing your meditation practice is a rich and meaningful experience, perhaps the truest expression of Buddhist wisdom is found in our relationships when we act for the benefit of others. And I will note that the reason I'm using the word holy in here is because earlier in the book I referenced a sutta in which the Buddha says that noble friends and noble conversation are the whole of the holy life. So I can't really tell you what, I mean, that's sort of an odd turn of phrase, the holy life. But we could say it's a recovery, you know, is a holy life. Yeah, this has, I guess, been an important point for me for a long time. And one of the things that, one of the reasons I like bringing together Buddhism and the 12 steps that you know, there is this sort of idea, or I don't know if it's an idea, but sort of culture of silence and you know, somewhat isolation. I mean, it's easy to be part of a Buddhist group and never get to know anybody in that group, you know, to just go there and meditate, listen to a talk, and then go home. And that's sort of the way it was when I first started to practice. I know there's been a lot of effort in the last couple decades to make things more social. But this still, I think there does persist this sense that what's really spiritual is being quiet, you know, noisiness. It's like, oh, that's not spiritual. And so, you know, in the recovery world, particularly in the 12-step recovery world, which is really founded in community, it's almost like the opposite, you know. I describe in here one of the chapters about the first time I went to a 12-step meeting, and at the time I wasn't identifying as an addict, I was accompanying someone else, as supporting them, and how, you know, I, at that time, I was already a Buddhist practitioner and sort of, you know, had this precious idea of what that meant. And then went to this meeting, and it was really noisy, and people were talking and laughing and getting up and getting coffee. And I was like, oh, these people aren't very spiritual. You know, it's like this very, so maybe when I'm in this book, I'm talking about myself or in my own experience and making assumptions that other people think like that. But it also reminds, because I've been thinking a lot about my book, Living Kindness, because reading back over that, because that's what I'm going to be talking about on 10% Happier later this month. And that book has, you know, a similar idea to this last sentence. While deeply developing our meditation practice is a rich and meaningful experience, perhaps the truest expression of Buddhist wisdom is found in our relationships when we act for the benefit of others. So living kindness is about taking the practice of loving kindness beyond just this internal effect, this internal experience. And, you know, and this is clearly a balance we have to strike between developing our inner development and then our outer behavior. And you know, as addicts, when we come into recovery, we have to do a lot of work on both sides of that. And the 12 steps are designed to help us to do that work internally and externally. You know, the first three steps, you know, have a sort of implicit internal impact, the admitting, the coming to believe, the turning it over. But they also have this outward manifestation, because through the admitting, there's the change in our behavior. We stop acting on the addiction. Through the turning it over, our behavior changes. The things that we are guided by change. And then, of course, the fourth step is, you know, very internal, but then it's taken outwardly in the fifth step, and then further on with the amends. And then again, with step 11, then we really turn to the inner work. So again, I think a balance between these is so important, but I do think that, and probably one of the reasons many of you are here, is that we get to a point in our recovery where we realize, I really need to do something that's not inventory that isn't turning it over. It's not admitting I'm powerless. It's something else. It's this development of mindfulness, of awareness, of insight, and ultimately, really an inner healing, which I think this practice can offer us. The wounds and the trauma of being an addict, or even the causes behind being an addict, take a lot of care. They need a lot of care. And sitting with it, we learn how to hold those wounds and to be gentle with them, and to cease to be so driven by them, because those wounds, when they aren't really seen and held skillfully and kindly, tend to trigger both painful, what I would call second layer emotions, like depression, anxiety, anger, and they lost the other piece I had, and it was in there, but they trigger the feelings, right? And then they also trigger the behaviors, the destructive behaviors that come out of those feelings. So, for us to sustain our recovery and our abstinence, most of us at a certain point have to go deeper with our recovery. And to me, this is what this practice, this Buddhist meditation practice of both of mindfulness and loving kindness, compassion, both those wings, can provide us this opportunity to really learn how to hold and heal those elements of ourselves. And part of that is also the insight that comes as that means that we start to see these things differently. We start to see our feelings differently. And some of those insights are very simple. The insight into impermanence, for instance, is so key, because it reminds us, there are these painful feelings that come, but they also go. And that knowing, when we hold that sort of in our mind, it's one of the things that allows us to just not be reactive to the feelings, not panic about the feelings. So that's one insight that helps us to hold it. And then the insight into suffering, to understanding that what I'm going through is human suffering, and that human suffering deserves compassion. Then we learn to actually activate this healing part of ourselves, this natural capacity to hold our own pain. And this, this takes some stillness. It takes a little quiet, which is why we need meditation, to be able to actually discern this sense that there's pain, but that there's another aspect of our mind that is capable of actually taking care of that pain. And this is, I remember being in therapy in my early 30s, and the therapist kind of talking about the where people who were not well parented have to learn to be their own parents. And this is kind of what I'm talking about, that we become our own parents, the good parents, that we develop this capacity to take care of ourselves. Excuse me, swallowed that badly. Well, I realized at the end of that I had completely lost the thread of what the part of the book was, which is typical. It's kind of the way the whole book is, actually. If you read it, you'll notice that sections will start on one subject. By the end of it, I'm talking about something else. But I think I was making sense, so I hope. Maybe I'll read this other part here. Because after that first long paragraph, I described this coming out of a retreat and getting into a fight right away with my girlfriend. Always fun. I'll skip over that. When we make the transition out of the retreat environment, it can be quite challenging to begin relating to others again. If we are attached to the states we've achieved in meditation, we will often struggle when returning. Just as we must work hard to strengthen concentration and mindfulness on retreat, we also have to work at letting go gracefully, at moving back into relationships with openness. In this process, we have to be gentle with ourselves, remembering to have compassion for the vulnerable places we have touched, and to be sensitive to those around us and how they are feeling in reconnecting with us. Sorry. A period of intensive retreat is one of extreme introspection. We have virtually no responsibility to others, and this can become a kind of narcissism, where we are so used to looking at our own thoughts and feelings moment to moment that we forget how to pay attention to the needs of others. Step 8 reminds us that our spiritual life isn't all internal or solitary, that we must be sensitive to others to see how we might hurt them in subtle ways and be ready to make amends. So, yeah, this is the dance between the inner life, being inner directed and outer directed, is, becoming skilled at that and graceful in that dance is part of spiritual maturity, becoming spiritually mature. And it's one of the reasons why I like to do hybrid practices. When I really got a good taste of this in my teacher training, we were having like 5-day retreats at Spirit Rock, where there were like about 80 of us in this teacher training, and we would sit together and we would have periods of silence, and then we would do all this work around the Dharma and have talks and have small group work, and so we were moving in and out of stillness, and I found that my meditation got quiet, very quiet, even though we were quite active, but it also really helped me to start to be more mindful in my actions. I've been talking about this with some of my teacher trainees as well, about how when you're guiding a meditation, if you both do the guidance and meditate at the same time, you're kind of doing this little dance between the two, and it's a good training. Because how often do we have this sense that like, oh, I just meditated and then I go to work or I show up and it feels like it's all gone. Like, and all of a sudden I fall into my typical habits. And it's one of the great challenges is to find a way, because we always talk about this, how to be mindful in our daily lives. And so having like I was describing this as having one foot in the boat and one foot on the shore. And we can sort of think of our daily mindfulness practice like this, where we try to maintain some touch, some contact with our inner life and our inner awareness, even as we are paying attention to what's going on externally, and kind of keep that balance going. Well, I'm going to continue here. It says, it's interesting that the Buddha's instructions on mindfulness suggest being aware of body, feelings, and thoughts, quote, internally and externally, unquote. We don't often hear what being mindful externally might mean. We are mostly taught to pay attention to ourselves when we meditate. Apparently, though, the Buddha wanted us to be mindful of others as well. To notice what someone else is feeling or thinking by watching or listening to them, and to respond to that with mindfulness, is the essence of compassion and the foundation of interpersonal harmony. Nice. There's one more paragraph in this that sort of goes in a bit of a different direction. I'm just checking the time. So I have 12 more minutes. So I'll go through this. As we make our amends list, opening deeply to the pain we've caused ourselves and others, the heart begins to soften, hopefully. The willingness to face pain internally and externally awakens love and compassion. The deepest veins of emotion start to reveal themselves in our heart. A sense of great sorrow can come over us, seeing how we, all of us, hurt each other and ourselves. We tap into the Buddha's first noble truth, the truth of life's pain. But we do it not from a place of fear or distaste, but from a place of caring and kindness. The great sorrow can open into a spacious love and acceptance. Tears may come as we open the heart chakra, that part of us physical in the center of the chest beneath the sternum, emotional and spiritual, from which love comes and goes. After my first retreat in the desert, this happened to me. I cried every day for a week. And the tears were cleansing, enriching, fulfilling. When we spend years drinking and using, holding in our feelings, covering over our feelings, wreaking havoc in the lives of everyone we know, running, always running, never coming home to our true self, we bury some essential part of ourselves. We bury it alive. When through this process of opening, we touch again the truth of our hearts, deepest craving for love, something bursts forth, and often it flows in a river of tears. What joy. It's one of those moments when I think I can actually write. Most of the time, I'm very skeptical, but anyway, sweet. So thank you all for listening. And we have a little time for questions or comments.
Hi, Kevin, it's Angela.
Hey.
Hi. Sorry, Bill, I'll go quickly. I saw you were just unmuting. Thank you so much, Kevin. That was, this is one of my favorite teachings in recent memory. I know there have been a few others that have, really hit me, but this is just, beautiful. And I don't know, maybe it was, one of my speakers in my AA meeting made the spiritual principles her topic. And the spiritual principle for step 8 is love. And I just wanted to share that because that seems appropriate to say. And so much that you said, but the one other thing that is just in sort of fresh up for me. I told you I did that day long on Insight Dialogue. And so I just was, really getting a lot of that in your teaching today. Just interesting to hear a little bit more, I guess, about how the Buddha, talked about being aware internally and externally and just, if people don't know about Insight Dialogue, I just found out about it. It's very interesting and just very much about that, internal, external, the space between. And so, thank you. This is just really, Yeah. And then also, you know, the emotion that's been coming up for me as I've been meditating recently, this like puts a, I mean, I know it's like cleansing feeling, but it just to read about it again and hear your experience. Cause I remember you telling that, you know, story about crying after your first retreat every day for a week and being like, this didn't work. But yeah, just that like, oh yeah, like I'm healing. You know, so thank you so much, Kevin.
That was also when I wrote that song, Vipassana Blues, was that week. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, hi, Kevin. It's Bill.
Hi, Bill.
Hey, you know, I was just kind of reflecting back on something you were talking about, that, you know, the feeling after a retreat. And the first one I ever went to was at Spirit Rock, and my wife was driving me home and coming over the hill, you know, heading back over towards Fairfax. And I was just like, I couldn't even look at people, and I couldn't leave my backyard for like 3 days. It was just this incredible, incredible feeling. And I'm going, how long is this going to last? And these thoughts were going through my head of how do I hang on to this? And, and you know, it just, I think it's with everybody. I've talked to several people that had
you know, accessible to us, and, that we can, it becomes easier to get to those places. And which is one of the reasons, you know, we have to keep meditating. But yeah, it's striking to me that when I go on retreat now, my mind very quickly finds that place that originally took quite a long time to get to. I mean, I was a slow learner, and I was also drinking and still an active addict when I started retreats. So there was that. But yeah, so that's great. Thank you. Thanks, Bill. Yeah. But you didn't have a fight with your wife after that.
No, no. I was like in tears going over the hill, and I'm just like, I couldn't even look at people. I had to and then I couldn't even leave my backyard. It was weird.
Yeah.
It's like, this state that I was in, I just said, I want to stay here for a long time.
clinging,
right, exactly, yeah. Thank you.
I see there's a question in the chat that it looks like we should address. I wonder if you could talk about getting stuck in feelings. I've been in a rut of sadness. I noticed that during and recently after retreats, emotions flow through me, but in the course of daily life, I can get stuck in emotions like sadness for hours, days, months. Do you have recommendations for tapping into those experiences of emotions moving and flowing through us? Well, first of all, that's from Glenda. Thank you for sharing that. Not a really unfamiliar experience for me. And I will say that I think this time in this moment in human history, it's just such a difficult time for everyone. I mean, the last few nights lately, my sleep is just like, oh, I don't know. Why bother sleep? Lying here is nice. You know, it's just like, you know, my body just kind of wakes up. I'm not like anxious or jolted or anything. I'm just like, eh. And you know, the mind states, the moods, very difficult. So I don't think you're alone with that. But a few things. One of the things that I have to look for is the pleasant moments, because there's a tendency to feel as if it's one continuous feeling of sadness or depression or, you know, discomfort. And if maybe that can happen, but it's generally, you know, feelings are impermanent. So look for those moments in the day when there's just a little space, when there's a little lightness. Maybe you step outside, or you see a baby in a stroller, or you get a call from a friend. And so that remembering impermanence, I think, is really important. Having compassion for yourself to realize, like, this is difficult. But also at the same time, knowing, like, that you're okay, that you can hold this. I believe that, we can develop the resilience to hold these difficult feelings. And certainly our meditation practice helps with that. I think just as talking about today, connection with others is so important. And that's one of the things that's been so difficult over this year. Because all of us depend on connection with people to feel sane. So, use the phone, wear a mask, and take a walk with friends, and just state also the sort of obvious things, like exercise is just really important. And I'm really bad about exercising. But I just have to, like, make sure I get out of the house, move my body, because the emotions get stuck in the body, and moving the body moves the emotions. It's a strange thing, but emotions are very physical. And that's why all the things we do physically, like sleep and eating, all the things related to physical health have effects on our mental health. And obviously that's true for addicts, particularly, drinking and using tends to screw up your emotional states. So, all those forms of self-care, both internal and external, I think of it, I use the basketball metaphor of the full court press. I'm not currently in therapy, but for years I had a regular therapist. I mean, up until just a few years ago, really, where I would just talk to her once a month if things were good, just to keep track, and a sponsor and all those, support systems, and just all the things. We can't, like, depend on one thing, because sometimes we do get this idea, like, oh, well, I'm working the steps, if that should do it all, or I'm meditating, that should take care of me, or whatever it is, or I'm taking this medicine, so I should feel okay. And my view is that we need everything, that one answer is never enough for dealing with difficult emotions. So those are my thoughts.
Kevin.
Yeah.
That actually reminds me again, because I remembered and then forgot again, about what we talked about with the, if you wanted to announce, like, in...
Oh, yeah.
Speaking
yeah.
of spiritual friends and support. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. This came up, I was talking to Angela the other day, because I got an email recently from someone asking, like, if I could recommend, like, a sponsor, or like a Buddhist recovery sponsor or support person. And I occasionally get those emails. And then it occurred to me that, this group, which is, many of you have been here for months, and some of you I've known for years, would be a great place to maybe start with. I was thinking maybe we could just put together a resource list of people who would be willing to, to whatever degree. I mean, it doesn't have to be like a permanent relationship. It could be just somebody that you, like, have a call with, or exchange some emails, or be like a buddy, or it could be more serious. It could be a sponsoring type or mentoring. A lot of people come into meditation and they don't know much about it, and they're not, they're not going to, I'm not going to have time to like give, you know, individual instruction to each person. But so I'm thinking maybe we'll create a, like a contact sheet where people that are willing could, you know, give their name and email address, and maybe like a, you know, a short couple sentences, like I've been practicing for 20 years, or I've been sober for a decade, and you know, whatever. So let's put that together, and since it's after the official time of closing today. Yes, go ahead.
Hi, this is David. I'm calling from the UK. I was the one that emailed you.
Oh, yeah, here he is, the troublemaker.
Yeah, I've stirred up all the difficulties, yeah. Yeah, yeah, but if that does come about, that would be something I'd be very interested in, because I have a sponsor in a 12-step fellowship in the UK. And I'm finding now that my Buddhist practice is really essential to my recovery, and I don't have that in common with him. And I've struggled to find someone who I could relate to in that way. Yeah. So